Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, May the 10th. We have a good show for you today. I'm going to be speaking with Fiona York about the homeless camp, which is set up at Crab Park, one of many homeless camps that have been established around the city over recent years. It's a fairly lengthy interview. And we get into some real depth about both the camp and the larger issues surrounding it. So please stick around for that. We have some good music. And we have a little segment on music waste, which is coming up at the beginning of next month. Before we do that, though, let's tell you a little about some programming coming up here on CJSF.
You are listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
Hi, this is Betty Levitt. And you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
Hi, this is Adam Cullen, and you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
You are listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc on 90.1 FM or on the web at cjsf.ca.
Hi, this is Hillary Scott, and you're listening to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc.
Hey, you're listening. Should I say I'm Jan Orden?
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Tune in every Wednesday morning, 6 to 8 a.m. for On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
The clouds will blow away.
My name is Magnus Tiefeld, and I'm your host for Speak Up today. We're talking about homeless encampments here in Vancouver. Homeless encampments in Vancouver have been, and really everywhere across the country, have been pretty much a fixture for the last number of years. Pretty much at any time there is an encampment somewhere, and in many other places in the province, there's been a lot of issues around camps in Victoria. Camps established in Beacon Hill Park in Victoria, in Prince George, in Prince Rupert, other places in the interior, camps in locations up the valley. But Vancouver definitely seems to be an epicenter for these encampments. Vancouver, as you know, well, I wouldn't say it's popular, but it's kind of it definitely is a magnet for people with people who are homeless, you know, because of the weather. It's, you know, in the wintertime, even when it gets really cold, it's among the mildest places in Canada. And when you're sleeping out, that's a serious, serious concern. You know, about a number of years ago, a camp was established in Oppenheimer Park in downtown East Vancouver, between Cordova and Pender Streets. And it was established there for quite a while, and I think it lasted almost a year. Eventually, the city and the province and the Parks Board resolved to move the campers out. As per usual, the promise was that all the people camping there would be found housing one way or another. And, you know, initially that was the case. But lo and behold, it really wasn't very long before a new camp was set up and established at Strathcona Park, also in East Vancouver, probably about less than a kilometer away from Oppenheimer Park. That camp was very high profile and very in the news. It was present for almost a year, and in some ways was even more high profile than the Oppenheimer camp. Part of I think what made those camps so high profile was, well, the fact that they are on highly traveled arterial roads, traveling in and out of the city. The fact that they were adjacent to residential communities. And that drew a lot of attention to him, and they were constantly in the news for good and bad. And often the coverage of the camp was not very kind and not really very understanding. One of the things we've tried to do here at CJSF, and I've tried to do, is shine a more informed light on what these camps mean, what life is like for the people living in these camps, and why they're there. One of my great resources has been Fiona York. She's a community activist and has been working with a group of folks working to support the camps and provide a public voice for the camps, and to talk about just what it is that's going on with these camps. The Strathcona camp was finally shut down last year in 2021, and at the end of April, just over a year ago now. And again, the promise was that all the people camping there would be provided with housing, and that the problem the camp was meant to solve would no longer be present because everyone there would be housed. I talked to Fiona last May, or might have been early June, and even at that point, just after the camp had been closed, we were already starting to see a resurgence of people sleeping in doorways and on the streets. All those folks had, for the most part, been choosing to live in the camp, where there was some established services, a community, and a lot more. Perhaps not surprisingly, given the history, by late May, a new camp was already forming at Crab Park. If you're not familiar with Crab Park, it is on the waterfront, just at the foot of Main Street in Vancouver, sort of situated between the container port on one side and the heliport and Canada Place and the Seabus berth on the other side. It's really actually quite a nice park there on the waterfront with a great view of the mountains. Well, by May 22nd last year, a new camp had been established there, and that camp is still there today, and that's what we're going to be talking to Fiona about today. Here's my interview with Fiona York about the Crab Park Homeless Camp.
Welcome, Fiona York. Fiona York is a community activist and advocate who's been working with the homeless, and particularly around homeless camps here in Vancouver for a few years now. Welcome to the program, Fiona.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a while since we talked. I think the last time you and I talked on this issue was last spring, just after the homeless camp in Strathcona Park in East Vancouver had been shut down. And at that time, we've been told that there's a promise that everyone from the camp would be rehoused. Since then, a new camp has been set up in Crab Park. And this one has been much more sort of under the radar than the high-profile Strathcona camp. Can you tell me, I know it's a big question, but can you tell me what's been happening since last year? And how quickly did the camp at Crab Park establish itself after the end of the Strathcona camp?
Sure. Well, as you say, it is a really big question because a lot has happened and it's felt like really a roller coaster and pretty dramatic over the last year. Although, as you say, that the current camp at Crab Park is quite a bit smaller and less on the radar than Strathcona Park. A lot has happened, a lot has developed. And in terms of how quickly it manifested after Strathcona Park, it was pretty apparent. Like at the end of Strathcona Park, there was a lot of issues with the eviction process and how people were housed. It was violent in a lot of ways. It was an eviction despite whatever was said in the media or by BC Housing or by the service providers. There were many, many issues with the way that took place. And one of the big things was that the Park Board and BC Housing repeatedly claimed in the media and repeatedly in whatever public sphere that everybody from Strathcona Park was housed, and that was completely not true. There are many people who were not housed, and that became apparent very quickly, immediately afterwards, that there are people who were not housed and were still kind of clinging to the outskirts of Strathcona, who were in the vicinity, who just like constantly just kept emerging more and more people. And even up until like the last couple of weeks for me, finding or meeting people who never got housing from Strathcona Park. So there was just a really big false kind of advertising that there was housing for everybody from Strathcona Park. And as you say, the housing was not successful in many cases. And so that didn't work for a lot of people, and people became unhoused once again.
I know when we spoke before just on this issue, that one of the issues with a lot of the housing that people were offered and that was made available was the lack of, I think, privacy, autonomy, independence that some of these housing options had, where sure, you had a place to sleep, but it wasn't, you couldn't have friends, you couldn't have guests, you, anyway. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. All of those things are true. And I think it's really the way that housing is designed for people who are low income, and that it's temporary in nature. And then as we see more and more, and has become more and more apparent, it's not suitable and not safe the way that it's advertised. Like, we just saw the Winters Hotel fire, and there's like numerous articles and now so much exposure about the fact that SROs in many, so many ways are not suitable. And this is, that was, became sort of the crux of the argument that with Crab Park, when we went to court and with the injunction process, and what the judge ended up siding on was that housing that's being offered is not suitable in so many ways. And that was kind of what happened at the end of Strathcona, that there was some housing. And I do have to say, some of it has been successful. There have been success stories. There have been people who've done better as a result, just having that stability and security. But there's so much of it is designed in a way, or offered, or the housing that's made available is, it's temporary in nature. It's a room as opposed to an independent suite. Some of the housing that was offered after Strathcona was an improvement, because it was a room with a bathroom, which is definitely much better than an SRO room where everything is shared. So there was some recognition and acknowledgement that that was something that was important. So the hotels and the new buildings that were purchased did have washrooms that went with them, and some were newer buildings. But one of the trends and tendencies with BC housing and supportive housing now, or so-called supportive housing, is that housing that's provided for people who are low income is program-based housing, meaning they're not actual tenancies. People are considered program participants rather than tenants. And that means they have far less rights. And people were being evicted almost immediately under a program agreement. People can be evicted with a couple of hours notice. And so even in the first week of people being housed from Strathcona Park, I was hearing of people being evicted. I was meeting people and talking to people from Strathcona Park who've been evicted in the very first week of being in their housing, and evicted for very small, flimsy reasons, like their dog accidentally set off the sprinkler system and they were given a couple of hours to vacate their room. So just that whole design and what people signed and the way the housing was set up was that it was maybe for 1 year or 2 years, it was program based. And even the ones that were full tenancies have all these restrictions that you've mentioned, that people are not allowed to have guests, they can't have their friends and family, they're not independent, there's many rules around it, it can be very difficult to access. And then thirdly, just the actual structure, the physical structure of the housing that's offered, that they're not full independent suites. There's maybe a few small handful of people who actually got maybe like a temporary modular hotel or housing where there is a kitchen and bathroom, but for the most part, maybe a bathroom or not even a bathroom. And then for those who were offered housing or given space in SRO or even a shelter, which is what happened because they ran out of the housing, we've just seen over and over that those are not safe or suitable in so many ways. SROs now, it's just coming to light more and more that they're not safe or suitable, and shelters are not housing, and that was what was being offered. And some of those have closed now, so there's even less. There's the one shelter that was set up at the Plaza of Nations after Strathcona Park so that people could be indoors, and that closed within 6 months. Two of the buildings, the Holiday Inn, has now closed its doors to the low-income residents, and another hostel in the downtown area also closed its doors, so people had to be kind of reshuffled into other housing. So it was designed to be temporary, and with low-income or so-called supportive housing, again, so often just the very structure of it makes it very difficult for it to be successful.
So, yeah, really, so these solutions aren't really permanent solutions. So the camp at Crab Park started up pretty much following up on the Strathcona camp. And I think even beginning as soon as the summer, there were efforts from the park board and maybe also the Port of Vancouver, who I believe owns that land, to close down the camp. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, and I should mention that the Crab Park encampment is actually coming up on one year old. In a few weeks, it'll reach the first year anniversary. So that makes it now, it's already longer than Strathcona Park encampment. So even though it's kind of flown under the radar, it does have quite a long history. And so I would say that, yeah, even from the end of Strathcona Park, back in the spring, before Strathcona Park ended, there was a memorandum of understanding that was signed by the province and the park board in the city that basically pledged from all three levels that they would not allow encampments in the future. There was a very small note on there saying that if there was an encampment that they needed to provide amenities for it. But mostly it was just a document saying that all three levels of government would not allow encampments to be set up again in Vancouver. So because of that, and because of the efforts at Strathcona, there definitely was a marked kind of adversarial approach from the park board. And even before people were going to Crab Park to shelter, there was some kind of hostile architecture, what's called hostile architecture, that was set up. So there was a line of concrete blocks that were placed all around the edges of Crab Park in April of 2021, so right at the end of Strathcona, very likely in anticipation of people trying to shelter there or an encampment setting up there. And also a lock gate was placed on the west entrance, what used to be like a totally open entrance where people could drive into the park if they were setting up for events or dropping off supplies, or for whatever reason people could drive in, and there was a lock gate that's there to this day. So it was kind of, there was kind of this adversarial approach even before there were people who were trying to shelter in Crab Park. So the camp there set up on May 22nd, and so that's why we're coming up on the anniversary, which will be May 22nd, 2022. It was a small number, and there was constant attendance and engagement with the park board, where people, the bylaw currently stipulates that people can shelter in a park overnight but have to take their tents down in the morning. So there was that just constant engagement where park board was forcing people to take their tents down in the morning, and then there was threats of taking belongings. There was a lot of conflicting information where the park board would seem to be sort of trying to place measures or kind of regulate the engagement or the way sheltering happened, but was very inconsistent and really difficult to follow, and just made it really, really very difficult for people to shelter. And also people being told different places in the park and whether or not they could have belongings and whether they could stay during the day. So all of that kept shifting, and, you know, it's just a very difficult situation. And then shortly after people were told to move to the western section of the park, there was, that was in July, so it was just a couple of months later, there was a first order that was issued saying that people could not shelter in that in the park. And so there was a first eviction attempt, which was quite dramatic and quite violent. And there was VPD and park board were in attendance, and they tried to have everybody leave the park, and they were not totally successful. Some people stayed. There was a second order that was issued in September, just a couple of months later. So another effort that was even more directive and saying that people had to immediately vacate the park, and there was going to be remediation of the landscape. So people had to leave, kind of like what happened in Oppenheimer and Strathcona, where fencing went up and they did remediation on the ground, which meant that everybody had to be out of the park. So they attempted to do that. And again, that eviction attempt was not successful. There's just a lot of advocacy and pushback. And so not everybody ended up leaving. And then thirdly, the park board was talking about an injunction. We, our team, our legal team, in speaking and engaging with residents at the park, were very aware, very, advocating for their own right to shelter in the park, decided to launch a case against the park board, saying that those orders were unfair and should have been set aside because the park board wasn't following through on their end. The park board was claiming that there was sufficient shelter and therefore people should not be allowed to stay in the park and could be evicted. Whereas, as we just discussed, there wasn't sufficient shelter and what was being offered was not suitable. And that was the basis of the Parks Board's claim for the order. So the residents of the park, the encampment, filed a suit against the Park Board saying that those orders should be set aside. The Park Board responded by filing for an injunction.
So what was that injunction seeking that the Park Board was?
The injunction was seeking to not allow people to stay in the park. So over and above the orders that were already in place, there were two orders saying that people couldn't stay in the park, which was what was done at Strathcona as well. The injunction was basically to say that they could force people to leave the park and would carry with it the potential that they could have police enforcement, which technically they could have even without an injunction, but it did carry that extra weight that there would be police involvement and enforcement, and it would be very, very hard to withstand that. So it was definitely a pretty heavy threat a jeopardy of the camp being able to stay. And the injunction, of course, is used numerous times around the province with encampments and around the country. It's usually the tactic that's used when there was a brief tent city in the parking lot adjacent to Crab Park, which was under Port Authority jurisdiction. There was an immediate injunction by the Port of Vancouver that they ended up winning, so that park had to leave and ended up going to Strathcona Park. So it is a tactic that's often used, and it's very hard to withstand. It's very hard to fight. It's happened. It's all over Vancouver Island, all over BC, and usually it's really hard to fight. And when a camp goes to court, usually they don't win against an injunction because usually what happens with the court is they'll back up the municipal body. So whether it's the park board or the city or whatever the municipal group is, they'll tend to support that.
So you and your group launched a suit to oppose that injunction.
So the suit that the residents launch was actually against the two orders that were saying that people couldn't shelter in the park. And then the park board responded by filing for an injunction. So we ended up with two court cases. One was the residents of the camp against the park board, and the other was the park board against the residents. So there are two separate court cases. But because that happened, rather than just a brief court hearing and granting the injunction, the two cases were put together, and there was a much longer lead time and a full hearing, a two-day hearing that was held in court. So at that time, residents mobilized around preparing for the court case, doing affidavits, working with the legal team. And then we had a two-day hearing in court in December 2nd and 3rd to prepare for those two court cases. And both the injunction attempt and the request from the residents to set aside the orders were heard at that time.
And what was the ruling that came down? Well, I guess they were both set aside, right?
Yeah, so both were successful, and it's really a major milestone and very unheard of. Of course, during that time in the fall of 2021, last fall, another interesting thing was happening, which was that we'd been following the case of a sister tent city in Prince George, BC, which was very similar in terms of timelines and size. And they had also gone to court against an injunction, and they had won against that, which was really, really amazing. And really at that time, like, just so groundbreaking and so amazing that that happened. So that was prior to our case going to court in December. And as I said, these injunction attempts happened all over the country and all over BC. And it's really rare that a case is successful, but the one in Prince George, they had really great arguments and very, very similar to the one in Crab Park. And so it set a precedent, and very similar arguments around whether or not there were suitable spaces, and whether it was done in a fair way, whether people had the need or the right to shelter, all of those things very similar in Prince George and in Vancouver. So January 13th was when the decision came down from the judge and ruled both that the order needed to be set aside and that the injunction was not granted. So it's successful on both counts. And again, really amazing, those precedents, the hard work of the team and the residents in filing the affidavits and just working really hard on that. The two orders saying that the park was closed and the people could not shelter in the park at all. It was quite amazing because the very next day the signage was gone and the fencing was gone that had been put up, and the camp had been was allowed to stay and the injunction is set aside. It's not unheard of that the park board could attempt again for an injunction or something similar, but for the time being it meant that the camp is allowed to stay, and that's why we're closing in on a 1 year, and the camp has grown since then as well.
That was Fiona York. That's part one of our interview with Fiona today. We're going to get to part two in just a minute. It's a really deep issue, these camps, and so we wanted to explore it properly. Before we do that, though, here's a song from Canadian artist Julie Dwaron. This is from her most recent album, I Thought of You, and the track is called I Gave You the Key.
There was never a plan. No need to explain. And here I am. See how to begin.
That was Julie Dwaron, and You Gave Me the Key from her album I Thought of You, released earlier this year. Let's take a quick look at Vancouver weather. It's going to be a rainy week all week, pretty much this week. I don't know about you, but it has not been a great spring. I'm really looking forward to the actual warm weather where I can get out in shorts and some light clothing. But for the moment, it's umbrella time. Today, it's going to be mixed cloud and sun with a high up to 12 degrees, 30% chance of showers, going down to 7 overnight with a 60% chance of showers. More of the same tomorrow, highs to 14, and that's going to continue through to a bit more rainier on Wednesday, bit of a break in the weather on Friday, and back to the rain on the weekend. So hopefully some genuine spring weather will be coming our way soon, but for the moment, keep your umbrella close at hand. Now we'll continue our interview with Fiona York. We've been talking about the homeless camp at Crab Park and a recent injunction that they got, or a recent injunction that they were able to challenge and get set aside, that has allowed the camp to remain there and even create an environment where some services are being set up for the camp. We'll continue with part two right now.
So what has that meant for the conditions in the camp, and I guess the atmosphere and well-being for the residents? That must take a lot of stress off the situation.
Yeah, absolutely, because I guess with, so often when people are unhoused and people are homeless, there's so much of that stress of the instability, the insecurity, the lack of permanence, not being able to like have things in one place, not being able to have belongings, not being able to attend appointments or access medical care or outreach or housing appointments or any of that, is so often what people experience when they're without housing. Having an encampment makes all of those things a little bit more possible, and then not being under constant threat of displacement makes it even a little bit more secure, so people can access all of those resources and stay in community and stay with people and have just that little bit of sense of stability and supports. And even before that decision came down, again, being in a community, in one place, where resources are able to be provided, like food security, medical support, outreach, housing outreach, all of those things were being offered throughout the encampment. But even it's a little bit more accessible, even with the camp being a little bit more secure and not being under constant threat and harassment. Now, I have to say that the park board engagement and what I would call harassment has continued, because they're still pushing back against that decision and trying to regulate the camp in whatever ways possible. But as I mentioned, that memorandum of understanding did state that if a encampment exists and needs to exist, then the park board must provide amenities. And so in the weeks immediately following the decision, they did provide some of the things that the camp had been asking for a long time. So having washrooms, which seems so basic, but having a washroom for the camp, running water, which hadn't existed for the whole almost year prior to that, and access to electricity, which is essential for charging phones and communication and all of those things. So made the camp life a little bit easier and a little bit more stable, having to have those amenities provided and being able to push for those amenities and resources. But also another thing that's very groundbreaking is the bylaw, the park board bylaw, as I mentioned, stipulated that people could stay only overnight in a park and not stay during the daytime. But there was a very small mechanism when that bylaw was updated saying that a general manager could designate an area of a park for daytime sheltering. And they'd never made use of that before. But now, for the first time ever, there is a portion of Crab Park that is stipulated as for daytime sheltering. So people had kept their tents up during the day even prior, but were told or harassed every day to take them down. But now there actually is a designated space within the park where people can put up their tents and leave them up at night and leave them up all day. And that is lawful and allowed in that section of the park. So it that again is quite groundbreaking. It had never been used before. It's not enough. It's not big enough, and it should be in more places. But again, it pushed the park board to finally use that mechanism for the first time.
What do you think led them to make that decision? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, it was the pressure of the court case, that knowing that the camp is allowed to exist. And so it's better to, I guess, in their minds, to create a space, which is good and bad, because the space, as I mentioned, is too small. It's sort of too restrictive. It's too much. It's very much under the sort of the order and jurisdiction of the park board, and just that extra engagement and harassment that goes with it. But they realized that the courts had said that the camp must stay and people should be allowed to stay. And so that mechanism always existed. And so finally they made use of it, and they could not just issue orders. And in the judgment, it's quite amazing. Like, there's many useful things and comments that are in there that the judge made, that they're kind of, the park board is kind of responding to. So one is that there needed to be some procedural fairness and some engagement with people staying in the park who are actually impacted by a decision or an attempt of an injunction that would have a severe impact, of course, on people who are highly vulnerable by being unhoused. So there needs to be that extra effort around participation or engagement with people in the park. There needed to be the consideration of whether or not housing or shelter was actually available and not just being passed on by third-hand information, which is what the park board was doing. There needs to be some consideration of what kind of shelter is being provided. And it also kind of speaks to the charter rights for people to have access to shelters. So all of those things that were kind of set out by the judge in that decision, the park board is kind of being forced to respond to. And that seems to be what they're recognizing, or what they're attempting to do with some of the follow-up, which again is kind of is problematic in itself, but in some way, you know, well, obviously it is steps forward in terms of setting precedents around access to shelter and access to public spaces.
So, as you've mentioned, we're coming up on 1 year of the existence of this camp. What happens now?
So now there is that sense of security and stability that people can stay in this community, and it allows people to kind of develop a little bit more structure and resources because they have been there for longer, and there's not that constant threat of being made to move and the lack of stability, and it's just a sense of permanence. And so just kind of again, kind of the infrastructure that's provided within the camp, being able to reinforce that a little bit, like having the harm reduction, the overdose prevention, the food security, medical access, regular residents meetings, all of those things are just engaged a little bit more and provided a bit more securely. But also it's now, because that there is that permanent spot, there are more people who are able to access that and not under fear of being made to move, and not under fear of that sort of lack of stability. So the camp definitely has grown from, at one point it was down to like 10 people or less, and now it's closer to 70. So definitely there's more people there. There's more kind of need for resources and support. So we're always asking for community support and donations and just that extra support. But also, because it set these really important precedents, it kind of allows for that solidarity and building on that, which is around tying in with some of the other things that are going on in community. For example, a couple of days ago, Pivot Legal Society launched a report on street sweeps. And this really is kind of part of that, because it's just the idea of people's belongings being removed. That was what was happening in parks and public spaces so often. And so it just allows this camp to be part of some of these movements. So also the charter rights, which now This case doesn't influence how that affects the rest of Canada, but it does kind of allow a bit of a launching point for establishing or talking about some of those rights a little bit more. Access to public space not being penalized, not that approach where there's fault or penalizing or punishment around people who are being houseless just allows a bit more kind of organizing and solidarity and be able to push back on some of those things and link with some of the other efforts that are going on in community in different levels and different capacities. Also the pushback against the housing that's being offered. So kind of having a bit of a platform or ability to talk about that more, that's finally with these recent cases coming to light more and more media attention on that. So looking at what provides better types of housing, finally having that recognized. And throughout all the work that I've done in encampments, I know that was like a constant theme we were talking about, is having the autonomy and being peer led and independence and what better housing would look like. And finally, those conversations and dialogues are happening more. So I think on the one hand, what's being achieved is having that extra stability of an infrastructure and security of the camp itself. But on the other hand, being able to link to those other goals and struggles and being able to kind of further some of those rights and capacities and just that dialogue around housing and people who are houseless and people in public spaces.
Do you feel, you know, these camps aren't going away. The authorities, whether it's the city or the Parks Board or the province, you know, every time one of these camps emerges, you know, they come up with all these, I wouldn't call them solutions, but actions meant to end that camp. And in theory, or at least from a public perception point, get everybody housed. But I mean, as we saw with this one, you know, I mean, the Strathcona camp had barely been shut down and this one emerged. And, you know, same thing with the Oppenheimer. Do we need to recognize these as maybe part of the process towards people transitioning to more stable housing? Or do we need... Go ahead.
I think that is one of the things that has been said from the beginning, is that there isn't enough housing. That's really obvious to everyone. There absolutely isn't enough housing, no matter how much was purchased last year or how many more hotel rooms. The type of housing that's being offered is not suitable or not appropriate. But there are people who are unhoused and need to be somewhere in the meantime. And if they're pushed from one place to another, there's basically this vacuum. Like, where are people supposed to be as they're waiting for this housing that we know doesn't exist? And so encampments should be part of that continuum. There should be a role or a place for that, where people are naturally gravitate towards living in community and finding a space and finding some kind of organization or community or something that feels safer. And there's a reason why it's a phenomenon, why it's happened over and over and over in Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, in BC and across the country, Vancouver Island, everywhere. People organize in communities, and encampments will always exist, and there always will be a need until there is not only enough housing but enough suitable housing that actually work for people, where people don't just cycle out. And as you said, I do see people who just cycle out because the housing is not working for them and it's not changing. There's not really listening to what people are saying about why it's not working for them and making that work better. So until that all happens, there just needs to be a role for encampments and whatever that looks like, so that there is somewhere for people to be safely as they're waiting or until that housing actually comes online that's going to work for them and is going to be sufficient.
Great. Well, that seems like a good place to end for today. Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Fiona York.
Thank you.
Fiona York is a community activist and advocate for the homeless and for, particularly in this case, the homeless encampment at Crab Park. Thanks for joining me today, Fiona, and we'll have you back again soon to talk about this issue again. It's so important.
Thank you so much for having me.
The homeless camp at Crab Park is coming up on its one-year anniversary of its establishment, one of the longest-running camps in recent memory. That's coming up on May 22nd. And the need for the camps to form some part of the solution or some way of providing housing does not seem to go away. So thanks for Fiona for speaking with me. That interview took place last week. And we will, as I said, have Fiona on again sometime soon. Here is Bird Note. Let's listen to the birds.
This is Bird Note. Writer Ada Limón's new collection of poetry, The Herding Kind, features a number of poems about birds, including this piece that many birders can relate to, about the challenges of IDing birds.
It's the season I often mistake. Birds for leaves, and leaves for birds. The tawny yellow mulberry leaves are always goldfinches, tumbling across the lawn like extreme elation. The last of the maroon crabapple ovates are song sparrows that tremble all at once. And today, just when I could not stand myself any longer, a group of field sparrows, which were actually field sparrows, flew up into the bare branches of the hackberry, and I almost collapsed. Leaves reattaching themselves to the tree like a strong spell for reversal. What else did I expect? What good is accuracy amidst this perpetual scattering that unspools the world? As much as we love to name things, I feel like really what draws us to birds is wonder. So I think there has to be that balance of wanting the information, but then also surrendering to the wonder, the unknowing, the mystery.
Find more of Ada Limón's poetry and a link to her new book, The Herding Kind, at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
Music Waste is Vancouver's annual underground music festival. It's been going for nearly 20 years. It's coming up next month on the weekend of June 2nd through the 5th. You can find more information about the festival and the lineup at musicwaste.ca or follow them on Instagram at musicwaste. This is our documentary about Music Waste by Jamie Sesford.
When we think of music festivals today, we still find ourselves married to this image of Woodstock. We have open fields, big stages, thousands of people probably suffering from questionable hygienic choices, and lots of booze and drugs. And to be honest, not much has changed. If anything, the idea of a music festival has been streamlined into a rite of passage for young adults. Coachella, into Sasquatch, into Sled Island, into Pemberton, there's just so many choices. And they're all big productions and frankly aren't very cheap. But sometimes, you don't need to spend hundreds of dollars or travel hours away to see great music or party hard. Of course, if you're from Vancouver, you probably already know this. Because you have Music Waste. Every June, for 4 days and $15, all you need to do is hop on your bike and bounce around from venue to venue. That's it. That's Music Waste. And for Vancouver's music community, it's kind of become this unofficial kickoff to summer. But there's a lot more to it than that. Music Waste comes from a true anti-establishment sentiment, born out of a sarcastic discontent with corporate music and their sponsors. There's a spirit to this festival that's rooted in history and has allowed for it to survive for 20-plus years, outliving many of the big-box competitors that it was created to protest against.
For me, I think Music Waste is this space that is very unique to Vancouver.
This is Eleanor Waring. She's a coordinator for Music Waste.
Because the festival doesn't take itself too seriously and because it's kind of volunteer-run and most of the bands are really relaxed that are playing it as well, when stuff does go wrong or something happens with a venue or something has to shift, everybody kind of really has this can-do attitude where they're like, yep, okay, we're just gonna, that doesn't work, so we're gonna see what are our other options, like who can I call in for favors, like, and because everybody loves Music Waste, they're often very willing to help and to kind of overcome those hurdles.
And that's the big takeaway from Music Waste, the message from the community to itself. Don't take yourself too seriously. Now, when the original started in 1994, this was the idea. It was to push back against a festival that did take itself far too seriously and forced people to kind of bump elbows and pay to play. Initially, it was a one-off, but then it started to grow. After a couple years of hiatus, this festival was revisited again in the new millennium. This is Dustin Bromley. He used to be a coordinator for Music Waste.
So as I understand it, there was New Music West, which was, very, let's say, corporation-funded, and, you know, there's a lot of your Nickelback-style bands, your radio rock bands, and apparently their selection process was a little more, elite, or they were definitely going after a certain sound, very, very just, like, easy on the ears, and these bands, as it's been told, we're doing things that have been done, you know, thousands of times before. Cool. And a group of people started a one-day festival called Music Waste, which, as I mentioned, is a big, big middle finger to the sky to New Music West. And in subsequent years, it expanded to a multiple day festival.
But it really wasn't until the revival in 2004 that Music Waste became the festival that we would recognize it as today. This is Sarah Cordingly. She's one of the people that was around Music Waste at the time of its rebirth.
I was an intern at the Terminal City Weekly magazine, and some of the people there, in particular, John Cow, who was the music editor at the Terminal City at the time, and Darren Atwater, who was the editor, they sort of remembered or thought back nostalgically about Music Waste and thought they should resurrect it, and they... I believe they actually talked to Chris Wood, who was one of the original organizers. They bought it from him for $50 or something, or maybe even less, and they sort of took it over. And the first year was really successful and really fun, and to me, really sort of embodied exactly what it was meant to be, where it was sort of just chaos, and everyone was just organizing it out of the good of their hearts, and no one was really making any money.
While New Music West no longer existed, the ideals did. The idea that networking, self-promotion, and presentation were more important than the artistry behind the music was, and still is, a point of frustration within the Vancouver scene. During her time at Terminal City and then Only Magazine, Sarah and her team actively tried to disrupt superficiality through Music Waste and its promotion.
We often wrote sort of silly reviews of the bands that were, again, meant to just not take it too seriously. And who wants to read, you know, 85 band descriptions that are all just like talking about how great they are and how they're the next so-and-so, or, you know, how they're breaking boundaries and coming up with a new sound. It just seemed more fun to kind of make up funny stuff or tell, you know, funny stories that we knew about them. We were just so sick of bands trying to sell themselves to us, I guess.
Now, the festival's approach to actively pushing back against industry norms wasn't necessarily shared across the local scene. Bands trying to propel themselves beyond Vancouver work hard to cultivate image and press kits and didn't appreciate being called out for it.
Some of them were offensive, actually, I should say, in retrospect, that some of them were really too far and were just like vulgar and awful and rude. And some of them were maybe too true and were sort of actually poking fun at people. Something weird happened that was sort of a protest to Music Waste. And I think what happened was, this must have been in 2005 or six, and it was at the Columbia or Mike's Tavern. But the band, the Book of Lists, were boycotting. And then for some reason at the last minute, they decided to just like hijack a show and play. So we just like got a bunch of texts that that they were setting up at the show. And I don't know, maybe they were friends with the other bands that were playing, but they like set up and played a short set. And Cam and I like biked down there as quick as we could to watch them. And it was like kind of great because it was, you know, they were sort of mad at us, or they were sort of doing it as a protest or something. But we thought it was really great, and it was really kind of fun to have a surprise, or to have, you know, a show sort of be sabotaged in a way that resulted in people getting to see a great band.
But this don't take yourself too seriously attitude fueled the largest criticism of the festival: artistic elitism.
Antagonism sort of between some bands or some artists and what they perceive as like some sort of snobby or elite group of people who are putting this on. But I think that's just based on a misconception that these people are being snobby or elitist, because they do have to choose a limited number of bands.
There are times that we have to make a decision and say, okay, no, this band has played quite a few years in a row, and we should give that spot to a new up-and-coming act. In the most part, I find that in the general spirit of the festival, bands are very supportive and kind of manage that themselves even.
Although Music Waste does frequently see many of the same faces, the turnover is fairly regular. During his tenure on the committee, Mark Richardson was tasked with scheduling the festival and recognized the emergence of new, younger acts.
Because Music Waste, they take a lot of chances on newer bands and younger bands. There's obviously a lot of familiar faces that you'll see from years past, but there's always try to make sure that there are new younger bands being selected each year, and that draws in their fan base or their friends. So I think if you do that year after year, you're just going to keep drawing in new people.
There was not enough infrastructure for emerging and weird local bands to sort of showcase themselves in a sustainable way. And I think that the more you support musicians, the more musicians support you. And historically, we've tried to be as inclusive as possible and allow people to have Music Waste shows, like to put on their own shows if they can find a venue and make it happen if they didn't get in. And we tried to support them with as much promotion as possible if they were willing to accept passes.
In making music more available and more accessible, Music Waste has opened the door to the community and has allowed artistic integrity to remain at the forefront of the scene rather than who you know or how much money you have.
Music Waste has consistently been very inexpensive, so the passes are $15, and that, if you think about the fact that in the past 20 years, like, everything has gotten more expensive in the world, the fact that it has remained this low price is incredibly remarkable. It's really important to everybody to keep it inexpensive, so I don't see that changing anytime soon, or at all. I don't see that changing ever. Actually, I think Music Waste would probably stop existing before it got more expensive.
This is the commitment Music Waste has made to Vancouver. But, like, whatever. Music provided by Future Star, Devours, and Pavel. You can find them and a whole bunch of other bands from Vancouver on Bandcamp. Thanks to CJSF 90.1 FM, and special thanks to Eleanor Waring, Dustin Bromley, Mark Richardson, and Sarah Cordingley. I'm Jamie Sesford. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for that. The Music Waste Festival is coming up June 2nd to 5th right here in Vancouver. Most of the venues are pretty close together in East Vancouver. As they say in the dock there, you can bike from place to place and see a whole bunch of bands. Check it out at musicwaste.ca or follow them on Instagram at musicwaste. That's our show for today. Thanks to Fiona York for talking to us about the Crab Park Homelessness Camp. My name is Magnus Tevold. I've been your host for today. This program will be back tomorrow morning with the special edition of Intravenous, hosted by Robin. And thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right after this. Have a great day.